previously on Popping Collars.
I recently did a marriage counseling thing with a couple, and the very first session, one of them said, "Damn," and they were like, "Oh, sorry." I said, "That's okay, that's okay." Well, by the end of the session, they were saying some like they were using the F word. They were saying mother F. They were like
at each other, like
no, they were just telling stories, and they were and then she made me so effing pissed that I was like, I just wanted to take a S on her bed. It's like, oh my god,
oh, no.
I didn't say carte blanche, you know.
Ooh, under the stole.
I know. I just had to go like bathe afterwards, but.
Welcome to episode 60 of Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection of religion and popular culture. I'm Liz Easton in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm going to be your host today. And with me are three co-hosts, Greg Knight in Palm Beach, Florida. Greg, what are you up to? What do you do?
Oh, Liz, I have survived the Holy Week. I've survived all four egg hunts and all four Easter services. And yeah, I am in pure survival joy at this point.
That's awesome. We should mention to our listeners that we're recording this on Easter Monday.
In my real life, I serve as the director of children and youth ministries at the Church of Bethesda by the Sea.
Awesome. Thanks, Greg. Lucas Mix is with us here as well from Seattle, Washington. Lucas, what are you up to?
I am an independent academic working with Harvard and Princeton at the moment on the history of definitions of life. So I'm actually preparing for a conference on astrobiology and the search for life elsewhere.
Awesome. You're also doing some supply priest ministry at my home parish where my parents go, and they love you.
St. Stephen, Seattle. It's awesome.
And finally, Martin Elford, also in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon. Martin, what are you up to?
Well, I'm at Grace Memorial Episcopal Church just outside of downtown. And even though I did fewer Easter egg hunts than Greg, my eyes are still spinning in two different directions today.
Me too. I did almost nothing. So I'm the canon to the ordinary of the Diocese of Nebraska, which some Holy Weeks means that I'm super busy helping out in congregations that don't have clergy or whatever. This time I really just like dressed up and stood around in liturgy, which I felt pretty guilty about, actually, and kind of ashamed of myself, and also really loved. So it was a kind of special, bittersweet Holy Week for me in that way. Mm-hmm. So today's episode is going to be about the BBC show Sherlock, which we're all pretty big fans of, and we know that a lot of our listeners are too. It's a totally binge-worthy show that there have been four seasons of it. And it's based, of course, on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's famous Sherlock Holmes stories, which are the fictionalized stories of a private detective or a consulting detective in London. And they first appeared in 1887 and then ran all the way until 1927. And they mostly appeared in serialized forms in different publications and most famously in the Strand magazine. He is a detective who is blessed with these incredible powers of deduction. Much of what we think of when we think of detectives and detective shows and procedural crime dramas and all the rest is kind of modeled on Sherlock Holmes. And in fact, the Sherlock Holmes character is probably the most, he may have been the first fictionalized detective, but probably is the most well-known. And in the Guinness Book of World Records, they list him as being the most portrayed movie character in all time. So it's a story that just sort of lives on and on and on. The BBC show, it has been running for four seasons. The fourth season just wrapped up, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a pretty wonderful modernization of the Holmes story in a way that real Holmes enthusiasts have found particularly satisfying. That's sort of the premise of Sherlock. And my question for you all as we get started is, what do you think it is about this story that makes it still feel so relevant? You know, more than 100 years old, we've been telling this story over and over and over again in all different kinds of ways. and it's a character that just lives on. So what do you think it is about Holmes and Watson that we love so much?
For me, I think there's two things that really stand out. One is what I would call the romanticism of reason. That is, there's this idea that the world can be figured out, and Sherlock Holmes is just this master of figuring it out. And so there's this just wonderful sense that there's someone out there who gets it and can explain it to you. And alongside that, there's this really great, always sort of confusing relationship between Watson and Holmes that makes you want to know both of them. And I think really humanizes both of them, that they've got good aspects and bad aspects. And so it's fun, I would say, as a model of friendship. You get to participate in the good and the bad of knowing someone really interesting.
Holmes is this archetype of the character who's sort of spent all of his experience points on becoming brilliant to the cost of, in some respects, his social IQ. And that's a trope that has been imitated a ton of times since then. So there's this incredibly brilliant guy who, it's usually a man, isn't it? I don't know that I can think of an example of a woman in this trope who has this level of genius, but is sort of constantly sort of breaking stuff and breaking relationships. And the sidekick who, you know, in some respects is the audience, in some respects fills in for us in our incredulity and wonder, has this role of repairing things as he crashes through the world. And I guess the original, it's just particularly, we've seen that done poorly a lot of times, and this is just a particularly good version of that trope, and a particularly attractive one.
So I grew up as a child of the 80s. So when I make an Encyclopedia Brown reference, does that mean anything to anybody?
Yes.
Nope. So you know, Encyclopedia Brown books were huge, I guess, when I was a kid. And this was about a sort of a kid detective. And the kind of selling point of the book was that it would give you, I don't even remember, like maybe six mysteries that you would read sort of chapter wise. And then the answer to the mystery would be in the back of the book. And so if you would read the story and you would try to figure out like what was the clue that allowed Encyclopedia Brown to solve the mystery. And then you would turn to the back of the book and see if you were right. And the thing that I liked about that idea in those books is that it kind of holds up a mirror to us as readers, that we tend to take life passively a lot of times. We just sort of take things in. We're not really noticing what's happening around us until someone says, oh, pay attention to this. This is important, right? And so as you're reading those books, you're kind of you're struggling to pay attention. Whereas mostly in life, I'm just kind of obliviously kind of walking through. And so the appeal of something like Sherlock is, you know, what is that like kind of experiencing a character who's always plugged in, who's always paying attention?
Right. Like you think, you know, I'm thinking that a real kind of basic trick, if you're feeling anxious, is to just start focusing on what is in front of you in very basic ways. Mm-hmm. And so that I think of that type of mindfulness as sort of a calming mechanism. But for Sherlock, it seems to have kind of the opposite of, like, he burns out a little bit on it. And you know, he's on drugs and he's self-medicating his way sort of around this hyper mindfulness that maybe has gone a little too far.
Well, yeah, he's drinking from the fire hose as opposed to, I think of mindfulness or prayer as having this focus. And for him, the lens is open so wide, and that becomes, there's a cost to him for doing that.
The really obvious things that we haven't mentioned about why this story lasts is just that the original stories are really well written. Yes. And easily, I mean, they were written for serialized magazines. They're pretty basic and straightforward and smart. And I keep a volume of the Conan Doyle stories by my bed, and I pick it up often when I can't sleep. You can jump right into them.
I was sort of amazed when I read the originals just how much it is meant to be hard science fiction.
Yeah.
like Jules Verne, it really is like this cutting edge technology. So it was cool to watch Sherlock really start, you know, using technology in the modern incarnation. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's very much in the spirit of Conan Doyle.
Right. Cause like fingerprints in the original story were brand new. So yeah. Every time that Holmes takes a fingerprint, the readers would have been like, oh my gosh, it's crazy. And in the
what is this
one,
witchcraft?
Yeah, what is this exactly? In the contemporary ones, they're like projecting what appears on his smartphone, like right onto the screen. I thought all of that was really smart and it's fast. Mm-hmm. Like it's really quick.
Yeah, but again, I mean, the thing that this show, the BBC show, does really well is that, you know, and I think Martin was the one who said this, Watson is your character. That's the stand-in for you as the audience member. And it sets that up right away. You know, Watson's the first character that we meet on the show. Like, it starts from Watson's point of view and then meeting Sherlock and all of that stuff. The anger that he can sometimes have at Sherlock, the awe that he can sometimes have, the frustration that he can sometimes have, like that's all the things that you as an audience member are also kind of experiencing.
For me, I think Sherlock is all about flirting. That is to say, I mean, you've got Watson and he's got this very complicated relationship with Sherlock. And the question is like, how much is he going to be intimate? How much is he going to trust? You know, when he knows he gets all of these benefits, I mean, there's the danger, there's the excitement, you know, there's more control over your world.
There's fame.
So, I mean, for me, it's sort of like Sherlock is this God figure who's very appealing and like romantically appealing, but also dangerous because powerful. And so the question is, how much is John going to enter into this world of Sherlock? Which, you know, at first glance seems to be the best view of the world. But then when he starts getting into it, there's all of these, you know, dark places. Mm-hmm. And does he want to know the dark places are there? And is that about reality or is that about illusion? How do we deal with the world when opening your eyes can cause pain as well as joy?
Well, and it's interesting to frame it that way because Watson is struggling with PTSD. So like he's all, you know, all too familiar with how dangerous the world can be and how much it can hurt him. And now he's standing before this relationship that is alluring in a lot of ways, but will it bring the type of pain that he knows, you know, he's vulnerable to, like we all are. So we're a podcast about spirituality and religion and pop culture. And I wonder sort of what connections, I think we've already touched on several of them. In one way, you can look at Sherlock and think that it's sort of agnostic or even it's definitely an agnostic worldview. Conan Doyle was a kind of famous spiritualist and was interested in life and death. And there's at least one passage early in one of the original stories where Holmes makes a very Holmes-like case for God as sort of the ultimate point of deduction.
In the show and in most modern incarnations, there's sort of this parallel between Sherlock's brain and Watson's heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, it's a critique of the romanticism of deduction that, you know, your brain will only get you so far.
I like the image of head and heart enormously. In many ways, it's a show about two people, both of whom have massive blind spots and who each is, they're somehow complete together, so that Watson is able to fill in the relational aspect of life for Sherlock, who proudly / apologetically self-identifies as a high functioning sociopath. Sherlock, by contrast, is able to fill in this entire world of intellect and exploration.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about friendship, which is, I mean, in the Christian tradition and in other religions for sure, is really kind of a bedrock understanding, mm-hmm. you know, of how we understand Jesus and how we understand one another as followers of Jesus. And our culture now doesn't always puts a lot of stock in friendship, real friendship, especially between men and among men.
Yeah, I mean, the scripture, like, right, you know, this idea, this simple sentence of I've called you friends, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like that's an amazing... It's an amazing moment. Like, it made me think of how Holmes was trying to talk through his best man speech at Watson's wedding on the show. And it's basically, you know, this dialogue, just like Jesus is sort of having in John, this sort of, you know, he's just kind of free-forming this thing. But it all boils down to this idea of, you're my friend. Like, you are my friends. I don't know how to say this, though. And then, you know, it's this complicated mix. But yeah, this idea of friendship, that's a powerful stand, especially when you see someone as something of a superior, you know, as you know, the way Watson would see Holmes or the way the disciples would see Jesus. This idea of, you know, your superior calling you a friend.
As a counter example, I think that Sherlock does everything right that I can't stand about Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
That is, it, you know, friendship and romance both are not about finding someone who completes you.
Right.
They're about finding someone with whom you can share the best and worst aspects of yourself in a way that the best aspects get better and the worst aspects also get better.
That kind of choked me up a little bit, Lucas. That's really beautiful.
That is really lovely.
We've lost Liz.
Sorry. Okay, I'm coming back.
But it is, I mean, this Christian idea of brokenness that gets such a, I think, bad rep in our modern culture, for me, just gets to the heart of, you know, how do I think about the broken parts of myself as lovable? And if you can tell a story that somehow shows that, that's really powerful.
Yeah. And I was thinking, like, this, the last few days with the, you know, the Holy Week and Easter readings, and then now going onward into the Easter season, that the friendship of the disciples is such a, you know, with, if they weren't friends to one another and like bound together in Christian love, that story wouldn't have gone anywhere. You know, like, no one would have sensed the resurrection. No one would have reported on it. They wouldn't have challenged one another. Like, walking together down the road to Emmaus, like, that is two friends who are lifting each other up and holding each other together. And that even, you know, in that brief absence of when Jesus is not with them, they have created a relationship that allows them to have hope, you know, and sort of prime their spirits to receive that good news. And it's just interesting to me that, like, that's such a cornerstone of the gospel. And it's a thing that we seem to have moved beyond in a lot of ways.
Gosh, even that simple idea of, like, the sending of the 70 and this idea that you're going to go, but you're not going to go alone.
Yeah.
You're going to go with someone that's going to support you and partner you. You know, that's an amazing, I mean, gosh, like, those are nameless people who are given sort of an amazing gift in that moment as apostles in Christ of, like, here's a shoulder that's going to help you along the way. And that's what it all comes down to, you know, that is the gospel message.
Two by two, Watson and Holmes.
Right. A late friend of mine was an academic who offered a definition of spirituality, or at least healthy spirituality, as being a context where you find healing, belonging, and meaning. Mm. And I think those are big themes in the show. So while it does hint at an agnostic perspective on reality, In that respect, it's very much spiritually grounded. This is about a pair of people. And I'm struck in our conversation how almost exclusively we're talking about the two lead characters. But I suppose that's how it functions. Everybody else, they're very nearly props who create catalysts for these two people's relationship to get deeper. But it is all about how the two of them are finding healing together, how they're finding belonging in one another, how they're finding meaning in their work and in their relationship. They're somehow figuring out together how to be fully human, which, you know, in spite of itself, maybe in spite of itself, is a gospel story.
Sherlock is using his incredible gifts for good. Like, he's a benevolent, if he's a sociopath, which I don't think he is, he's not just a high functioning one. He's a benevolent sociopath, which is a contradiction in terms, right? Like, he could be using these gifts to like play the stock market or be a professional poker player or something.
Well,
but
I think Mycroft has. I mean, Mycroft has sort of thrown himself behind running the British government and possibly the US government in a way that he thinks will benefit the world, but it's very impersonal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
And I think Sherlock's refusal to play the what do they call it? The great game is Doyle's word for it. Is a very humanizing aspect of Sherlock's character. How do you do concrete personal good instead of abstract global good?
So Liz, were you the one that talked about mindfulness before?
That was you, Greg. You talked about mindfulness before.
Did I?
Yeah.
Okay. I may have used that word, but here's the secret behind the podcast. I don't know what that means. So like, I've heard this idea of like this spiritual discipline of mindfulness, or that this is some kind of spiritual thing that people do now, is like engage in something called mindfulness. I may use that term, but I use it in a way that I don't know why I'm using it or what I mean when I say it. And so I'm curious if like any of you guys have any insight into what that is, like as a spiritual, like
I would say from my Buddhist practice that mindfulness is the process of being aware of your surroundings without filtering it intellectually, like how to just be present in the moment without being anxious about the future or the past or judgment. It's become this big pop culture self-help thing in the West, where I think it just refers to applying your mind to anything. And so it can be very unmindful. So I think people use it in a number of ways. For me, it's all about how to fully be in the moment, or more in Christian language, I would say to live in eternity rather than to live in the physical world.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I sort of understand it in exactly that way, Lucas. And my experience of having any kind of practice around that has to do with being especially present, like in a sensory way, because I'm kind of I'm up in my head a lot. So it has to do with like pausing to consider how my body feels and how I'm experiencing something in my feelings as they are expressed in my body, I guess, in kind of a sensory way, to bring it out of my head. Because I'm like I'm a worrier. I'm a kind of obsessive worrier. That's the main thing, has to do with worry. So mindfulness has to do with that. And today my spiritual director is actually telling me about her centering prayer practice, which involves her not using. So a lot of times in centering prayer, you use a word that you return to when you find your mind kind of wandering. And what she does instead is tries to imagine how her body feels when she's experiencing a particular word. So if the word is like loved or cherished or something like that, rather than returning to that word, she returns to the sensation like in her gut. And I thought that was a really interesting way to think of mindfulness, maybe particularly as someone who words can be my friend and my enemy, both. I thought that was interesting.
I like the definitions we've heard so far. I will, and I hope I can say this without sounding cynical, I think one of the ways it's used popularly is by people who are embarrassed to admit having a prayer life. There's something naive or archaic about saying I pray, whereas I don't know. It's like the difference between vitamins and supplements. You know, yokels take vitamins, but grownups take supplements. And similarly, you know, an intellectual adult does not pray, but I certainly could be mindful.
That helps me sort of understand a little bit better when we think about the characters and how the characters experience life, and like where, you know, because that definition of mindfulness sounds liberating, because it sounds like a letting go of judgment and of, you know, this idea that I need to see the world in a very particular way. It makes me wonder. So like for Sherlock, the times when I feel like he's letting go potentially, it's when he's playing violin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's technique involved, but at some point you can let go and just make music.
Yeah, I would go a step further and say I think that he's got a he's addicted to judgment.
Mm. Right.
God, that's all of us, right?
Oh, isn't it?
Is it? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have that problem at all. Segment on this episode is staff picks, also called employee picks. We haven't quite branded this segment yet.
Yeah, Ricardo really likes staff.
He likes staff picks. He thinks that's good. I kind of like employee picks. Right. We're not getting paid anything, so it might be more like staff picks, volunteer staff picks, where one of us will recommend a thing to the rest of us that we're especially into right now or enjoying on any topic whatsoever. So today, Lucas has our staff pick. What have you got for us, Lucas?
Well, speaking of mindfulness, I have just finished The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama, Desmond Tutu, and Douglas Abrams. And it's all about how to bring about joy in our lives. And they have a really great introduction. They say, you know, this is not necessarily for Christians or Buddhists or atheists. It's just, you know, our reflections on how to be joyful and what the science is and, you know, maybe some tools for being joyful. So I found it quite useful in making myself more joyful.
Did you learn, like, what was the number one, like, how can I be more joyful right now? Like, did you learn, like, any little thing, like, that could just increase my joy immediately?
I have lots of things. The big one's probably gratitude, just reflecting on the wonderful things in your life.
That's awesome. I'm totally going to pick that up.
Can you imagine being in the room with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu? Like, what in the world would that? I mean, just smiles all around, right?
Yeah, like, I don't know if you've seen them together. They're like little kids. They poke each other. They're so funny.
But by the way,
I'm sure it is.
I'm like a lot of people. I take Lent. I take a break from Facebook. And Facebook, when you do that, starts emailing you like an incredibly needy friend, telling you about the amazing stuff you're missing. Something that surprised me was it said, you know, during the time you've been away, there were this many updates, there was this many people who liked things, and you were poked three times. And I didn't even know poking still existed.
Yeah.
From the early days of...
I was poked the other day, and it was totally like, ew, this...
Yeah, it was creepy back in 2006.
Creepy?
It's still creepy. Yeah, that's actually, I thought they clued into that and retired it for that reason.
Nope. Yeah, there's a picture on the back of the two of them dancing.
Oh, ooh. Desmond's got some moves there.
He does.
Well, thank you guys for joining us today in this conversation. This was super fun. And now you didn't spoil the fourth season too much for me. So I'm going to go back tonight and binge a little bit more.
Enjoy.
You can find all episodes of Poppin' Collars on our website, poppincollarspodcast.com. You can also find us on iTunes, where we hope that you will like and comment. And you can find us on Stitcher and any other place where you get your podcasts. And finally, we are members of the Episcopal Cafe's podcasting network, episcopalcafe.com. You can find us there and find all of your other Episcopal news and opinion needs met. Episcopalcafe.com.
So you didn't even know you had Episcopal opinion needs.
No, but you do. You have Episcopal needs, whether you know it or not. And they'll be met at the Episcopal Cafe.
Keep those collars pop.
Oh, yeah, keep those collars pop.
Where's Betsy? Where's Betsy when we need her?
Life.
I never know how to end these things unless Betsy's here.